I'm going to start with this morning with a question for you. What is your go-to movie? Now, this can be the movie that you own or the one you search for on Netflix or the one that you went to see the most times in a theater. What's the movie you go to when you need mindless entertainment? When you don't really want to have to pay attention and you don't need to because you know all the scenes by heart. The one that can lift your spirits when you're down. The one that can walk with you through your melancholy. What's the one movie you really don't want to be without? And notice, I didn't say the best movie. What's your go-to movie? Now, I'm going to give you about 10 seconds, and then I'm going to ask you, if you're in the sanctuary, to say your answer out loud. And if we all say it at once, then nobody's going to be looking at you funny when they hear yours. So we're going to all say it at once, and if you're online, and if it's not too, you know, too risky for you, type your favorite one into the chat box, and no comments, just no judgment here. This is a judgment-free zone, just like Planet Fitness. So, what's your go-to movie? 10, 9. Okay, when I drop my hand, we're all going to say it out loud. Ready? Go. I didn't hear a single one. Yay. All right. Well, it's really easy for me to give this answer. My go-to movie is Dirty Dancing. I saw it in theaters when it came out more times than I've ever seen a movie before or since. I own it. Even though I own it, I sometimes watch it with all the commercials just so I can feel like part of the community of Dirty Dancing lovers. I love the music. I love the dancing. I love Patrick Swayze. May he rest in peace. And I especially love Jennifer Grey. I had a huge crush on her. Smart, beautiful, intent on saving the world. Nobody puts baby in a corner. Now, there may be some of you who haven't seen this, and I'm going to talk about it a lot this morning, so let me give you a quick rundown. Jennifer Grey is Frances Haussmann, called Baby by everyone. She's a high school senior on her way to Mount Holyoke in the fall, where she will major in the economics of underdeveloped nations and join the Peace Corps and help save the world. She's gone with her father, who's a doctor, and with her mother and sister to Kellerman's Lodge in the Catskills for a 3-week vacation. And she quickly gets involved with the entertainment kids, young people brought in to dance and sing and entertain the paying customers. Well, Baby quickly finds herself drawn into the world of the entertainment staff. She's intrigued with Johnny, the lead dance instructor, and when Johnny's dance partner, Penny, finds herself pregnant, Baby borrows money from her father for Penny to visit a back alley doctor. Even further, she learns Penny's dance routine, a routine she does with Johnny, so that they can perform at a local resort and no one will ever realize that Penny is missing. The operation, as you can imagine, this was pre-Roe v. Wade, goes horribly wrong. And Baby brings her doctor father in to save Penny's life. He does save Penny's life, but he assumes that Johnny is responsible for the pregnancy. He can see that something's going on between Baby, his daughter, and Johnny. And he is angry at Baby for deceiving him. And if truth be told, for growing up and for not needing him in the same way. In the most iconic scene of the movie, Johnny, who has been fired and left Kellerman's, returns for the closing festivities. He sees Baby sitting in the corner, and he tells her father, "Nobody puts Baby in a corner." And then they dance. And it's electric. You can imagine how excited I was when Jennifer Gray came out with a book called Out of the Corner. We probably better get that off there now because I think people are distracted. You can imagine my excitement when I found out Jennifer Gray had come out with a book called Out of the Corner. According to the morning show interviews, it's a book that packs a punch and that really gets down and dirty with Jennifer Gray. Well, I can attest that it does. I can attest that it does in a way that I do not like. Let me read to you just a little bit from the book. This section is early in the book. It's from a vacation that Jennifer, took with a rich Playboy boyfriend. She was 18, he was 30. She walks into the front room and she sees that all the other guests in the party have been out and now they've returned. She wasn't prepared for the return, and this is what she writes. Within a split second of seeing them, I was a paranoid, coked up teenager, sleeping with a middle-aged man I barely knew. I had no idea what was going on. Nobody was explaining to me what had happened, but it was clear that I was stuck in some alternate reality, and no one had any intention of helping me out. I put a shirt on. She was naked. I did some more coke. Smoked some more cigarettes, drank another rum, smoked the joints being passed around, and tried with everything I had to regain my boyfriend's amorous gaze or even catch his eye. Oh. That's not the Baby I know. The only thing harder than reading this about Baby this week was reading this about Jesus. It's from the Gospel of Mark, our parable for the day. On the following day, when they came from Bethany, Jesus was hungry. Seeing in the distance a fig tree in leaf, he went to see whether perhaps he would find anything on it. When he came to it, he found nothing but leaves, for it was not the season for figs. I've got to read that line again, right? When he came to it, he found nothing but leaves, for it was not the season for figs. He said to it, "May no one ever eat fruit from you again." And his disciples heard it. He cursed the fig tree. How many of you are aware of this parable? How many of you have ever been bothered by it? I should see more hands who have been bothered by this parable than who have read it. Jesus sees a fig tree. Maybe he's hungry. I'm not sure. He sees the fig tree. It's covered with leaves. He says, "I'm going to go see if there are some figs on it." And when he finds there are no figs on it, he curses it. "You'll die. No one will ever eat figs from you again." What is that? For me, there's no real question. This is one of the most difficult stories in all the Gospels to read. Now, as I've done throughout this parable series, I'm going to lean a lot for the next little while on the work of William Barclay, a theologian who's written commentaries on on every book in the Bible, I believe. And this is from his commentary on Mark. He admits as a problem with this story that it just doesn't ring true, right? Does that sound like the Jesus that you know? It doesn't seem like the Jesus that we know. It's sort of peevish and arbitrary, and it just makes me really uncomfortable. And secondly, there's another basic difficulty with this parable. You know, Jesus never really used his miraculous powers for his own sake, right? He didn't use them to get himself out of difficult situations. His healing was directed out. Everything was directed out. So it doesn't quite fit that he would want these figs and that he would blast the fig tree because it didn't give him what he wanted. It's very unreasonable. So if we place this story in its appropriate context, we're reminded that it was probably the Passover season, maybe the middle of April. And I didn't know this about fig trees, but fig trees, especially if they're in a sheltered spot, they can bear leaves as early as March. Now remember, we're talking about the Mideast, so don't think about the fig tree outside your kitchen window and think, oh, it's different. We're back in the Middle East. The fig tree could bear leaves as early as March, but never did it bear figs until May or June. Well, we're in April. Mark says it wasn't the season for figs. So for Jesus to blast his fig tree, that was unreasonable. It was unjust. And who wants an unjust Jesus? Now, some commentators have tried to sort of save this parable. I understand that. And they say that what Jesus was looking for, knowing it was too early for these figs, what Jesus was looking for was just some green figs, some half-ripe figs. But if you know anything about those, you know he was not looking for those because they are basically inedible. All right. So even if this parable belongs here, even if it's trying to tell us something about Jesus that we can't quite get, we're going to have to work at it, right? We're going to have to work to get it. So I'm going to offer you some possible takeaways from this, and I'm just going to trust you to figure out, you know, which of these might make sense to you or what you might do with it. For first, we can look at this parable as a condemnation of promise without fulfillment. So here's this green tree, right, with all these leaves, and you would think that it would have fruit on it, but it doesn't. I had never heard anyone preach on this parable, and it's not in the Revised Common Lectionary, the cycle of scriptures that we go through. So imagine my surprise and happiness when I saw that Reverend Tracy Blackman, a wonderful, gifted black woman preacher, preached on this very scripture last week at the Festival of Homiletics. Here are a couple takeaways from her sermon. The fig tree is a warning to those of us who would choose leafiness over fruitfulness. Jesus is not impressed with a leafy appearance. What he's looking for is fruitfulness. And she goes on later in her sermon and she says, if the church looks pristine and the neighborhood looks like crap, then the church has lost its power. Okay, maybe we're getting somewhere here. But the second way that people try to explain this, and I talked about this last week a little bit, is that this is a condemnation, especially of the people of Israel. That all their history was a preparation for the coming of God's chosen one, and now God's chosen one is here and they don't see it. I don't believe that for a minute. that God who keeps coming back to us, loving us, forgiving us, I don't believe he finally lost it and was angry forever, spiteful and mean. That interpretation leads to an anti-Semitism that is unchristian. I don't know. Part of me just wants to say it's a bad story and it's okay if I don't have any ironclad interpretation. Do you remember this? I used this quote in the first week. It's from C.H. Dodd. At its simplest, the parable is a metaphor or simile drawn from nature or common life, arresting the hearer by its vividness or strangeness. This qualifies. Arresting the hearer by its vividness or strangeness and leaving the mind in sufficient doubt about its precise application to tease it into active thought. To tease the mind into active thought. All right. Thought about it, and I still don't like it. But it does get me thinking about something else, about this dirty dancing thing, this Jennifer Grey thing, this nobody puts baby in a corner thing. Because I finished her book, by the way, and my heroine fell from grace, far from grace. My perfect image of baby, smart, beautiful, graceful, sexy in a chaste kind of way, always self-contained, saving Johnny as she prepared to save the world. And then I read the book, and what a mess baby was. I mean, Francis was. I mean, Jennifer was. I finished her book. And I watched the movie again. Honestly, it was probably the 27th time or so. And I loved it. My movie was no longer pure fantasy, escapism. Baby saves the world and makes my heart beat faster. It was real life, which is much grander, much messier, much less produced. I knew now about Jennifer Grey's desperation as she tried to navigate the dirty dancing love story while her personal love life was harmful and dysfunctional. I knew how her very Jewishness celebrated in Dirty Dancing, and probably the biggest reason for her getting the part, became her greatest obstacle. How after Dirty Dancing, everyone felt like they knew her, knew all about her, and could criticize her and be done with her. And I went back to the scripture and this failed parable, this totally out of character, witchy Jesus, you know what I mean? And I tried to redeem it. And I thought about what we've learned from the theologian William Barclay. I tried to find that one flash of lightning, that one flash of insight the parable wanted to teach me. And there it was. Nobody puts Jesus in a corner. That works great, except for the obvious. Lots of us put Jesus in a corner. Maybe not all the time. We love to bring him out of the corner to save the day, to take care of Penny, put Robbie in his place, help Johnny find himself and realize his value, help baby save the world, entertain us all with big production numbers at Christmas and Easter. Wait, I'm getting the two confused. But I do that, put Jesus in a corner. Paint him in a corner. feel like I know him, know all about him, know exactly what to expect from him, and goodness sakes, what would Jesus do? I know. And then I heard this from Will Willimon's Conversations with Bart. Listen to this. We must cultivate the art of relinquishment. Letting go of our dearest insights in deference to the Bible's insights. The gospel is not in our thoughts or our hearts, it is in Scripture. The dearest habits and best insights that I have, I must give them all up before listening to the gospel. Again and again, I must let myself be contradicted. I must let myself be loosened up. I must be able to surrender everything. Maybe this parable is simply inviting me to let Jesus out of his corner, to let him have his way with me. Honestly, is it really more challenging to deal with this Jesus who curses a fig tree for not having figs out of season than it is to deal with the Jesus who says, sell everything you have and give the money to the poor? Take chances on the side of the road with the Good Samaritan. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Who says I come to bring peace? I don't come to bring peace, but a sword. Wow. It seems like I should close with one of my favorite ever quotes from Annie Dillard. It's for those of us in church who insist on putting Jesus in a corner. Get ready. Why do we people in churches seem like cheerful, brainless tourists? Do you have it, Marlon? The Annie Dillard quote? Okay. Well, listen. That's the way parables are meant to be anyway, right? Why do we people in churches seem like cheerful, brainless tourists on a packaged tour of the absolute? On the whole, I do not find Christians outside the catacombs sufficiently sensible of conditions. Does anyone have the foggiest idea what sort of power we so blithely invoke? Or, as I suspect, does not one believe a word of it? The churches, the churches are children playing on the floor with their chemistry sets, mixing up a batch of TNT to kill a Sunday morning. It is madness to wear ladies' straw hats and velvet hats to church. We should all be wearing crash helmets. Ushers should issue life preservers and signal flares. They should lash us to our pews. May the Gospels be for us the practice of letting Jesus out of the corner. Think about that for a few minutes. Where should you unleash the power of the Gospels, the power of the good news, the power of Jesus Christ in your own life?